or business property that you no longer need, consider the advantages of donating it to your listener-sponsored radio station, KPFK. The process is easy and the tax advantages can be huge. Learn more about the advantages of donating property at kpfk.org.
Listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and on the web at kpfk.org, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Today we look at political turmoil in France with Sebastian Budgen and labor and the Teamsters at home with Joe Allen. We begin in France, where Prime Minister Francoise Bayrou's government has collapsed after losing a vote of confidence. President Emmanuel Macron's relentless drive to impose austerity has sparked yet another wave of resistance. The Bloc Everything mobilization on September 10th, which brought unions, students, and grassroots activists into the streets with another national strike set for September 18. To help us understand this moment, I'm joined by Sebastian Budgen, longtime analyst of French politics. Over the years, I've spoken with him about explosive social movements that have stopped governments in their tracks. Today, we ask, what makes this mobilization different? And what does this crisis mean for the left, the far right, Macron's presidency, and the future of the Fifth Republic? And then Joe Allen joins me to talk about his new book, Teamsterland, a story of the union's power, myths, and contradictions. In 2023, after a year-long contract campaign and practice pickets, the Teamsters came close to launching one of the largest strikes in U.S. history before reaching a last-minute agreement with UPS covering 340,000 workers. Leaders hailed it as game-changing, but some Teamsters worried about what was left on the table. And just months later, Teamster President Sean O'Brien stunned many by speaking at the Republican National Convention. From the near strike at UPS to O'Brien's embrace of Donald Trump, Allen shows how the Teamsters' fate mirrors the challenges facing the American working class. That's all coming up when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. France is once again in turmoil. Prime Minister Francois Bayrou's government has collapsed after a no-confidence vote, exposing the fragility of Emmanuel Macron's neoliberal project and indeed the depth of the crisis of legitimacy for his government. Bayrou has tried to push through sweeping austerity measures, cutting pensions, public services, even holidays, in line with EU fiscal rules and Macron's austerity agenda. But mounting resistance and the rise of a new wave of protests, the Bloc Everything movement, forced his fall. The new wave of protests, the mobilization for September 10th, brought unions, students, and grassroots activists into the streets under the Bloc Everything banner, with protests across France in a show of opposition to Macron. France deployed more than 80,000 police, leading to clashes and some 300 arrests, as well as some disruption to transport, schools, and other services. This is hardly the first time Macron has faced massive protest for his continual attempts to impose austerity, which most people reject. Will this time mark the end of his whole dogmatic agenda? To help us understand, I'm joined from Paris by Sebastian Budgen, a longtime analyst of French politics. Over the years, I've spoken with Sebastian about explosive movements from the Nuit Debout to the Gilets Jaunes that have repeatedly stopped governments from imposing austerity. Today, we'll ask, what makes this new mobilization different? Could this new social political movement reshape French politics? And what risks and opportunities does it pose for the left, the far right, even the future of the French Republic? Well, with all of that, I want to welcome you to the show. Sebastian and let the listeners know that you're an editor at Verso Books, a contributing editor for Jacobin Magazine, and on the board of the journal Historical Materialism. As I hinted in the intro, we last spoke about French politics at the time of the last French election, at which time you wrote a piece called Shrewd Tortoise on the New Left Review's blog Sidecar. And Sebastian is joining us from Paris, indeed, from a fête, as he may or may not explain, but Sebastian has been participating in this massive movement. So welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Susie. Actually, I was translating here for Chris Smalls, who you know very well from the Amazon Labor Union, who was here speaking at the Fête de l'Humanité, which is the big annual festival organized by the newspaper of the French Communist Party, which is a massive event of political discussions, concerts, food, and various other cultural and political events that happens once a year here in the very far outskirts of Paris.
That's brilliant. And I should ask, what is the scene 2 days after the mobilization for September 10th? And did you get much of an audience for Chris Smalls?
Yeah, I think Chris Smalls has a interesting audience here in France because people are very labor union and also about his involvement in the Flotilla for Palestine and the way he has linked questions of labor unionism, anti-racism and Palestine solidarity politics. So yeah, I think there's definitely a big interest for that. In terms of your question about the atmosphere, I would say there is a kind of waiting atmosphere because, well, we'll go into it later, no doubt, but the events of the 10th of September were quite important, but they weren't some kind of revolutionary uprising. On the other hand, have coming up on the 18th of September, a big strike and demonstration day organized by all the major unions. So the question is whether the 10th of September is the first act and the second act is the 18th, or whether this whole process will fizzle out quite quickly.
Well, let's hope that isn't the case. And maybe for our listeners, we should begin with the kind of institutional context, I guess. We've seen and talked to you many times, Sebastian, as Macron has continually tried to impose his austerity agenda, which is in line with the EU fiscal constraints. So I guess one question that you should address in that is to what extent his austerity policies are driven by domestic politics or external pressures, and whether or not, I said it was a decision of a dogmatic austerity agenda, it's whether or not there's any precedent for a French government to deviate from these rules, and what would it take?
Right. Well, that's a complicated question, Susie. Obviously, there are certain very harsh and doctrinaire rules about debt in the European Union, which are officially pronounced. But we also know that there are a lot of exceptions that are pronounced by the European Union for particular countries. And we also know that their particular countries have found various workarounds for these debt rules. So both under COVID and now recently with the rearmament drive in Europe, you'll have seen that the German government, for example, has quite explicitly decided to go against its own constitutional rules about the debt brake and so on and so forth. So there are these European guidelines or rules, if you like, that have been imposed, but each national government has a certain degree of flexibility about how they interpret them and the timeline on which they interpret them. The Macron presidency, which now is in its second term, and in its second term is now on its third prime minister, is attempting to use these European rules as a general justification for pushing through some extremely harsh austerity measures. Probably in the US, the ones that you have heard the most about is the attempt to try and suppress two public holidays, one of which is linked to the defeat of Nazi Germany during the Second World War, but already seems to be backing down on those. But yeah, there's an attempt to use the European rules as justification for a panicked kind of atmosphere around the nature of the debt in France. The notion has been cited that, you know, if France does not fall into line, that the IMF will be flying in and taking charge of France's economy and finances. that it will be impossible for France to finance its debt on the international markets and so on and so forth, and that all these things would justify this kind of extremely stringent austerity measures.
But in a way, it's kind of crazy because, as you mentioned, this is the third prime minister Macron has put in place. In each case, as they try to impose either pension reform or, in this case, taking away a holiday, people understand exactly what it means, that they will work harder for less. And so they reject it, or that their pensions that they've worked and paid for will be less. So maybe we should then move to the mobilization for September 10th, which was under this banner of Block Everything. Which sectors were involved in it, and how is it prepared? Who are these people? I read in one report that it started out with, I think, Les Essentiels, and that this was a kind of interesting semi-nationalist movement, but then the left tried to join in and it changed the character. So let our listeners know a little bit about this.
So the precedent for this, Susie, as you will remember, is the Gilets Jaunes movement, the Yellow Vest movement, which was an extremely powerful movement, which happened in Macron's first presidential term, which was an interesting movement because, on the one hand, it was sparked off by a relatively minor measure about gas prices and its relationship to ecology and the ecological transition. But when the movement ballooned into a big mass movement, it was something that France had not seen for an extremely long time. It was not a movement that was a traditional labor union movement, was not a traditional left movement. It was often very deeply rooted in, if you like, deep France, in the rural France, in the smaller towns of France. It was a plebeian movement in the sense of not being a strictly working class movement. It also involved self-employed, small entrepreneurs, artisans, and so on. It was a movement that was extremely deep in the sense that it brought into its perimeter people who had no experience with politics or collective organization of any type, for political, trade union, or any other type. And these people were swept up in the Yellow Vest movement. It was extremely virulent movement, very anti-Macron, of course. Many people feared at the beginning that it would be a far-right movement, a movement focused on immigration and so on, but it didn't turn out that way at all. And it involved these very, very big demonstrations, including in Paris, but also across the country, where people, in some cases, people who had never been to Paris in the whole of their adult life or lifetimes, came to Paris both to demonstrate and, if you like, to also see what Paris was like as a city. And the repression from the police was extremely violent vis-a-vis that movement. So it was a new kind of movement. It wasn't a radical left movement. It wasn't a trade union movement. It was very much a plebeian movement of much more complex character than previous movements. So some people were hoping that the Block Everything movement of the 10th of September would replicate, in a way, this kind of trans-class plebeian nature. And indeed, there were good reasons to think so, because indeed the first calls to Block Everything started on some fairly dodgy far-right or right, hard-right websites. But we're quickly taken up and invested in politically and ideologically by people from the radical left, from La France Insoumise, the Nouveau Parti Anticapitaliste, and other movements of the far left. So
can I just ask one question before you go on with that, just that one thing, because this does mark a departure in a way, either perhaps in the sense that there was space for the left to join these forces, and also, like I would say, a maturity in a way to understand that how Macron has to be. So maybe you could just say a little bit more about who joined in, who does it represent, the Greens, France Insoumise, Anti-Capitalist Front, if that still exists. Let us know.
Sure. So, as you know, the left and the trade union movement in general was very suspicious originally of the Yellow Vest movement, thinking that perhaps it was a far-right movement, an anti-immigrant movement, and so on, and didn't want to be too firmly involved. That lesson has clearly been learned today in the sense that there's been a much more greater openness to the 10th of September Block Everything movement. Ultimately, what seems to have happened is that it was a very substantial series of actions that took place on the 10th of September. So there were actions at the level of the big cities, of the medium-sized cities, of the smaller cities, and so on. There were blockages, blockades, and so on. There was no mass strike movement in the sense of the organized working class movement, but there was definitely sympathy from the organized working class movement in a way that didn't replicate the early period of the Yellow Vest movement. It was quite a young movement, a lot of young people involved, quite a left-wing movement in the sense of a lot of people from the radical left involved, La France Insoumise particularly, but also other forces on the radical and far left. And it was a movement that didn't counterpose itself. You know, one of the things that was specific and interesting, but also problematic about the Yellow Vest movement is that it counterposed itself to the union movement. It saw the unions as part of the establishment, if you like, political establishment, the media establishment, and so on and so forth, that was very angry and rebelling against. The 10th of September movement didn't see itself as antagonistic with either the trade union left or the political left, but it saw itself as trying to create a different kind of momentum, a different kind of dynamic that was somewhat more spontaneous, that was somewhat more diffuse, that was somewhat more decentralized, and so on and so forth. And it had a big impact, the impact that it had on whether you measure it economically, politically, ideologically. I mean, the Bayrou government basically fell because of this movement, because it was so afraid of facing it. But it was clearly not a movement on the same kind of mass level, plebeian level, that encompasses all sorts of people from the lower middle classes as well as the working class. And of course, one of the reasons that was the case is that it was happening during a weekday, a Wednesday, not a weekend. The big demonstrations that happened during the Gilets Jaunes movement happened often on Saturdays when people didn't have to strike. You know, people who couldn't afford to strike, people who were in precarious economic situations who couldn't strike, as I say, self-employed artisans and so on and so forth. The notion of the strike has less valency. They were able to be involved in these big demonstrations in Paris and other big cities on the weekend, whereas this was a weekday protest. So it has a different kind of profile from those traditional demonstrations. But as I say, the positive element of that is that it also looked forward to some of the more straightforwardly labor movement activity that has been initiated. There is a big strike day organized by all the major union confederations on the 18th of September, so in a week's time.
That's what I was going to ask you, actually. I'm sorry, just one thing, because you were talking about it as it happened in a sense like it was a one and done. Okay, so it's not that this was a sort of opening salvo, but enough of one, just even the mobilization of it, that how did that correspond to the vote of no confidence? Was it just the threat of this massive movement that gave the parties in the parliament the impetus to initiate this vote and then it was finished? That seems pretty easy.
Well, actually, interestingly, there was a vote of no confidence. There was a vote of confidence which was rejected by the parliament. So unlike previous prime ministers, François Bayrou, under the pressure, I would argue, at least in part, of the movement from below, felt that he simply couldn't continue without calling for a vote of confidence in his austerity measures. And that vote was rejected. So it's a different kind of configuration from the previous ones. The result has been the appointment of a new prime minister, again from the right wing, not far right, but more traditional right wing parties, as with the previous two prime ministers, and an attempt to try, at least discursively, we will have to see whether this has any translation into practical politics, an attempt to try and reach out to the Socialist Party, the center left, to try and reach some kind of alliance or compromise so that this government will last any longer than the previous two governments. But it's quite possible that it will last for an even shorter period of time.
So maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit again then about who's involved in the mobilization now for September 18th, the next stage. And you've mentioned the Socialist Party, which, in the last crisis, allied with the left, not with the right. Just give us a sort of overview of where the political parties stand in relation to the mass movement from below.
Well, as you will remember, in 2024, Macron dissolved the parliament, called legislative assembly elections, hoping on a gamble, really, on a wager that the left would not be able to unite, and that the left would be divided, and that either some kind of cohabitation with the far right or some kind of attempt to string together a coalition between the center-right and the Socialist Party would succeed in creating a government of national unity or something of that kind. In fact, the left was able to unite in quite an effective way around the new Popular Front, which involved La France Insoumise, which is France's main radical left party, the Greens, the Communists, the Socialists, and some other forces, and actually came out as the most successful party after the second round runoff against the far right, despite the fact that all the newspapers and media had predicted a far right landslide. And quite legitimately, the new Popular Front of these various left forces said that we have won the elections. We don't have an absolute majority, but we have won the elections. We call on Macron to call on us to create the next government. So Macron disregarded that demand from the left in a very undemocratic and arrogant manner and called on Michel Barnier, a member of the right wing, very small now parliamentary terms, right wing party, to create the first government. And then there was the François Bayrou government, also from the center right, different party, but more or less the same kind of political space. And now Sébastien Lecornu, who comes from the right, but is part of Macron's center right formation. So all of the three prime ministers, rather than corresponding to the electoral result in 2024, represent very, very small minority forces in the French parliament.
I'm really glad that you went over it. Go ahead and continue. I just want to get a better sense then of where momentum is right now. Because leading up to this, of course, we're talking about France in the context of the rise of far right everywhere, something that we thought perhaps a year ago was on the wane, at least maybe I did, but now, you know, politics now changes by the minutes and the United States is in a horrific situation. Many people worried that, and this is why I'm asking you where the momentum is, that any break with Macron would open the door for Le Pen and the far right in France. But from what you're saying, and from, I think, that this is not the case. So please let us know.
Well, Susie, I don't think we should kid ourselves. The long-term structural strength of the far right is very much present and is increasing over time. And their ability to not only win votes from the working class, the petite bourgeoisie, but also from now other sections of the population are increasing. There are sections of the French employers class, for example, who are now very interested in Le Pen and the Rassemblement National electoral program, especially since they've now adapted it in a more neoliberal direction. So that is the long-term thing that's going on, and they clearly have their wind in their sails. What is true is that on a more conjunctural basis, the notion that they simply would be able to sweep everything before them and win a majority has been rendered a lot more problematic by the ability in 2024 of the left to unite on a radical program, a program that was essentially pretty much 90% the same as the program of La France Insoumise, not the Socialist Party or any other more moderate element of the left, and was able to win the largest collective group in the parliament. We are in a situation that is extremely unstable, extremely turbulent. We have on the one side a far right, which is very strong, which is sinking its roots deeper and deeper into the population, and which is able to use the disgust that ordinary people feel about political and other forms of elites in a manner that pushes them towards a kind of anti-system kind of vote. On the other hand, we have a left that is now divided. The Socialist Party is desperately trying to find some kind of deal that will allow them to enter the government with the support of the center-right, but which is not in the dominant position. That's the very specificity of the French situation, is that the left is dominated by the most radical element of the left, which is La France Insoumise, which not only has radical positions on domestic policies, but also on international policies such as Palestine, for example. And so this radical left has been excoriated and denigrated in the public discourse as being anti-Semitic, as being a force of chaos, a force of anti-Republican, and so on and so forth. But it is the force that has the greatest social weight in terms of working class, multi-ethnic neighborhoods, and so on and so forth. And the Socialist Party is very unlikely to be able to break loose of it. So you have this internal struggle that's going on within the left itself, as well as the struggle between the left and the far right in a context where the center and center right is disintegrating.
You mentioned that on Wednesday, September 10th, protest, because it was the middle of the week, it wasn't perhaps as large and there weren't as many workers taking place. Now there's going to be another one on the 18th. But can you say that there's a united response from the trade union movement? Where do they stand in relation to this? Are they divided? Do they support the left?
So, no. What happened on September the 10th was that the people who were able to strike were the people who were in work, the people who have stable jobs in the public sector or elsewhere. It's the people who are on the more precarious end of the economy and also the self-employed who were not able to just take strike action. What is going to happen on the 18th of September is going to be a different kind of configuration. This is supported by all the main union confederations. So it goes from the most moderate CFDT through to the CGT and Sud, Solidaire, which is close to the far left. And that will be a combined day of strikes and demonstrations during the day. In France, as you probably know, there is a long tradition of unions saying that they are independent from any political forces, that they don't want to be subject to the control, as they were in the past, of the French Communist Party, as the CGT was, and so on and so forth. So there is a kind of hesitancy or a kind of doubt about being involved in anything that's explicitly political. But clearly, the unions are very engaged in this kind of action against an austerity program and are clearly still very, very angry about the fact that the government was pushed through the pension reforms despite massive popular opinion and enormous demonstrations through an undemocratic decree, basically. So that still exists. How that relates to the different forces on the political left and how those internally relate to each other is going to be a very interesting question over the next few months, because the question that is raised is, will there be another dissolution of the parliament leading to yet new legislative elections, or will Macron stick things out until his term runs out in 2027? Or will he possibly resign in 2026 before the end of his term and thus provoke premature presidential elections? So all of these things, all of these balls are up in the air as well.
Well, that's really sort of the big question, too, given that Macron continually tries the same thing with another yet prime minister from the right, ignoring, as you said, the last election and the strength of the left. So I think the question is, the legitimacy of his government is in question, and yet he pushes on. It's, as you said, I think you said, in a sort of almost arrogant fashion. What would it take to break it in this sense, and can it be broken? And then is this new movement sort of capable of, I don't know, along with the left parties, formulating a strategy that would understand how to confront EU fiscal and treaty constraints and everything else?
Well, you know, there are two big scenarios that are possible beyond just kind of trench warfare and one government falling after another month after month after month. One is the possibility that the Socialist Party will agree a deal with the center-right and the Macronists for a kind of temporary national unity government of some type that will push through a form of austerity that will be less harsh than what was originally proposed, involve some measures perhaps of fiscal justice, quote unquote, you know, on the super rich, but which won't change the fundamental terms of the situation. That is one scenario. Very risky for the Socialist Party to do that, because if it does that and the whole thing collapses into farce and disaster, then they are finished for a generation.
Right.
But they're very tempted by that possibility. The second possibility is that the far right decide to support this new government, that they try and condition it, give as conditions for that support more and more reactionary measures to do with immigration, to do with healthcare for immigrants, to do with various other of their bugbears, and that they enter into kind of de facto, if not de jure, coalition with the center-right. if neither of those two scenarios, which are both quite problematic for the people involved, as you can imagine, the far right doesn't want to necessarily be involved, given its popular base, in a government that's going to push through austerity measures any more than the Socialist Party does. If neither of those scenarios eventuate, then we're talking about an extremely turbulent period between now and the next presidential elections, assuming that they happen when they're supposed to happen in 2027. We're talking about governments that rise, that are overthrown through votes of no confidence after a few weeks, a few months, one after the other, and a phase of instability, which is going to be very, very profound in terms of French politics. Kind of a return to the Fourth Republic, if you like, before de Gaulle installed the Fifth Republic at the end of the 1950s, where governments rose and fell one after the other like dominoes. That is a possible scenario, and that also can have political effects that could be positive or negative in terms of the far left and the far right, in terms of how they play their cards in relation to it. And also, as you say, in terms of the popular mobilization that takes place. You know, will this big wave of demonstrations and strikes on the 18th of September, will this be a one-off, be a big day out, as it were? Or is this something that could take root and be carried through over the next few days after that, and have a kind of a momentum that leads towards a general strike kind of dynamic, as we've known already in French history? All of these things are very much up in the air.
This situation persists even if, say, Macron resigns, because you still have all of these problems. So I guess the question then is, what are the risks for the left? One is, do you see increased repression, co-optation, as you just mentioned, even protest fatigue, which doesn't seem to be the case for France? But what options does the Macron government have to try to divide the movement, undermine it, and without perhaps bringing in the far right, unless maybe that would be good for them?
Well, obviously, the wet dream of the Macron government is to split the Socialist Party and the centre-left, and to be able to bring on figures from the centre-left, whether they're actual members of the Socialist Party or previous members of the Socialist Party, or just people who are considered to be close to the Socialist Party, into the government, perhaps even at prime ministerial level, and be able to use those as Trojan horses, if you like, to push through neoliberal reforms. The problem with that is that it makes no sense from the perspective of the Socialist Party to engage in that kind of strategy, because they're already in a subordinate position. They only have the number of MPs they have now because they agreed to the new Popular Front with the La France Insoumise and the other forces on a much more radical program than they would have agreed to otherwise. If they were to go it alone, they would be wiped out. They would simply no longer exist. So, you know, of course, there are many of them that are tempted by this situation, but it's a very complicated existential question for them to assess. But that is what Macronists would love. They would like to be able to split the centre-left on those grounds and be able to win over a whole layer. As I say, it's not clear why anybody rationally would want to engage in that situation, given that Macron is the most unpopular prime minister, I think, in Europe. Even Keir Starmer is slightly more popular than Macron.
That's amazing.
He can't stand again for a presidential election. All of his policies are radically rejected by the population. It's difficult to see why you would want to tie yourself to that kind of a sinking ship. But social democracy has all sorts of mysteries in the way it thinks about itself, and it's quite possible that a section of it might think that this is the way to go to prove that they are responsible parties of government that deserve to win power in the future.
We'll probably come back to this after next week to see where it goes, Sebastian. But just finally, because France is always in the vanguard of the struggle against, let's say, the imposition of the neoliberal agenda, and yet it continues. So what does this crisis in France tell us about the future, I guess, of this project across Europe? Is France still sort of the social movement, I mean, the largest and most influential? In other words, what kind of lessons can the left draw from France's pattern of both protest and then institutional crisis?
Yeah, well, you know, France has always been in the vanguard from the 19th century onwards in terms of showing the way for how political, social, and other crises can interact and create revolutionary situations. That's not a new thing. I think what's perhaps interesting about the current situation is that we have a totally unusual situation in France, which is, as I said earlier, that the forces of the left are dominated by the forces that are most radical in that left. They're not revolutionary forces, etc., and so on and so forth, but they are very radical and they have very radical positions, both on domestic and international politics. That's not the case anywhere else in Europe, or I would argue probably anywhere else in the world. That leads to a degree of, on the one hand, that leads to an openness to the situation that doesn't exist in other national contexts. That leaves a space for social struggles, for trade union struggles, for other types of social movement struggles to be able to organize themselves and, you know, be on the offensive and have some kind of political echo. But it also means that the bourgeoisie, the capitalist classes, the establishment is absolutely terrified of what could happen should the left come to power, with the radical left as the most important faction of it. And they're more and more radicalized on their own side. You know, there are more and more declarations of big employers and capitalists saying, well, if we have to choose between the far right and the far left, we know which side frightens us the most. And it's not the far right. And the far right is in a big charm offensive with the employers at the moment to say, well, you know, all our supposedly left-wing policies, you know, we're prepared to bin them in order to gain electoral responsibility. So we see a very, very sharp polarization, both politically and socially, across the whole French context. In a way, that's very good, because it means that the political choices that are being posed on ecology, on foreign policy, on domestic policy, on tax, on any of the big questions that obsess people today are very clearly posed and will be posed more and more clearly. On the other hand, that means that the struggle, the final struggle, if you like, that will come on a social level is much more finely balanced, because nobody needs to tell us that the employer class is much better organized, much more coherent, much more unified in its action and much more radical in its intention than are the forces of the left and the labor movement. So, yeah, we are talking about a situation which will come to a head, we don't know exactly when, but in the short to medium term, and that will have massive impact and lessons for the left across the rest of the world.
Well, Sebastian, thank you so much for that. We're going to have to leave it there, but definitely we'll come back to you, because this is an unfolding situation and we can just hope that the French left proves to be well organized and strong and is able to counter this movement. We've seen this before, but not in this exact configuration. Thanks for joining us today. Sebastian Budgen is an editor at Verso Books, a contributing editor to Jacobin. He's on the board of the journal Historical Materialism, and we always turn to Sebastian to explain French politics, and he does it very, very well. I'm Susie Wiseman. Don't go away. Welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman, and in this segment, I'm really pleased to have Joe Allen with us, and we're going to be looking at the Teamsters, once the most powerful union in the U.S., and we're looking through the lens of Joe Allen's new book called Teamsterland. The Teamsters built enormous strength in trucking and logistics, commanding national contracts that set standards across industries, but their history, of course, is also bound up with corruption, mob ties, and ultimately decline under the pressures of deregulation and neoliberalism. Joe Allen begins his book with Britain's Len McCluskey proclaiming the Teamsters as the most iconic union on the planet, which should make the members proud. Joe says notorious would have been a better descriptor. And it is this gap between public perception and the dreary reality that Joe addresses in his book. Well, I kind of want to take it to 2023, when the Teamsters, after a year-long contract campaign and several months of negotiations and practice pickets, seemed to be building towards what would have been one of the largest strikes in U.S. history. And it took place in the context of rising militancy and a hot summer of strikes in Los Angeles, especially. And then the Teamster Union and the shipping giant UPS announced a tentative agreement to the contract covering 340,000 workers across the United States just a week before that contract was to expire, or as we probably would have said, in the nick of time for them. Teamster leadership hailed the agreement as historic and game-changing, but some Teamsters were concerned about what the agreement failed to address and what they left on the table by not going on strike. Then to fast forward a year to the summer of 2024, when the militant Teamster leader that people really thought was excellent throughout practice pickets and all of that, along with TDU, of course, the Teamsters for a Democratic Union, who organized it, President Sean O'Brien, in the summer of 2024, spoke at the Republican National Convention. So what does it mean that the leader of the Teamsters is a Trump supporter? There was no official endorsement, but Trump's the most anti-labor president probably ever in our history. So these are more questions that we're going to address with Joe. And let me just introduce him. Joe is a former Teamster. He writes in many places, including Counterpunch, Tempest, and Jacobin. And his new book, as I mentioned, is called Teamsterland. You can buy it. And he's also the author of The Package King, A Rank-and-File History of UPS, which we also discussed on this show. So welcome to the program.
Thanks, Susie. Thanks for having me on.
I'm trying to figure out where we should begin, but I kind of want to begin with the present, because we have this anti-labor president who, with the stroke of a pen, is wiping out union protection for federal workers. And of course, we've already seen what's happened in the private sector, despite the bright light that I think the last several years of militancy have been, both with UAW, with actors and teachers. And even that Teamster year of contract with the practice strikes, all of it looked so good. So where are we today, and what's up with this leader?
Well, that's a lot. Let me try to start work backwards a little bit. As we all know, the Trump administration very openly and basically adopted Project 2025, which was this wide-ranging attack on trade union rights, civil rights, the good things that people like from the federal government, the EPA, health and services, medical care, and adopted it while he also pretended that he never heard of it. And then once he got into office, began to swiftly implement it. These are probably, I think without any florid exaggeration, probably the most wide-ranging attacks on the working class and trade unions in a century, far greater than anything we saw under Ronald Reagan and the impact of the breaking of the professional traffic union, far more ranging and devastating than, say, the era of McCarthyism. I think this really goes back to 100 years ago during the post-World War I era, where you saw this toxic combination of anti-communism, xenophobia, straight-up racism. Some of this began during the war years under Wilson, the great liberal, then continued under Harding. And many overnight, you saw many trade union gains that were very hard and fought, and concessions that were given during the war years were wiped out. And it really took another decade and a half until the middle 1930s when that stuff was regained, and then there was a new level of struggle that opened up for working class people. Right now, we seem to be at the beginning of this wide-ranging attack. We're only 9 months into the Trump administration, and we still have 3.5 years to go. You know, the recent developments following the assassination of Charlie Kirk, whatever the motivations of the assassin are, Trump has made it very clear that he wants to carry out, in this kind of 9/11 feeling moment, he wants to carry out an attack on what he calls the radical left, which includes most of the union movement, except for unions that have publicly supported his nominees and, if not, endorsed him for president, such as Sean O'Brien, most notably of the Teamsters, Ed Kelly of the firefighters and a handful of other people. But the bulk of the trade union movement is opposed to the Trump administration and what it's doing. Though they face this existential threat, Susie, we haven't seen much of a response that would at all put the Trump administration on its back foot.
That's a very good place to start. And I want to ask, Trump is thought of as a far right, of course, nationalist, but also populist. And he's been able to win votes from the white working class, at least. And of course, in the last election, from some Latinos, some African-Americans, and of course, union members as well. And that's probably what's behind Sean O'Brien semi-endorsing him. But there's also within the ranks of the MAGA movement, those who want MAGA to be a pro-working class movement in a sort of fascist way. And here, with the implementing of the project of 2025 and attacking the unions, I think you would have expected a little bit more noise within the MAGA movement about this one issue, attacking unions. Have we seen it? And how do you read it?
Well, I think when you try to understand why has Trump been successful at appealing to a section of the working class, and certainly a section of the trade union movement, it's not as new or unique as sometimes people view it to be. I mean, I remember thinking back in the early 1980s, especially the 1980 election, which, you know, Jimmy Carter was humiliated in the election, Reagan triumphed with a landslide that he then further built upon in 1984. And there was a man there named Robert Brenner, who I think you know, wrote a very good piece and kind of raising an alarm bell at the time about why is it that you saw this collapse, an important section of the unionized working class, auto workers and so forth, who were seen as somewhat of the vanguard of the American labor movement, voting for somebody who was the complete opposite of them in terms of their history and politics and so forth. And I think Bob then, and I think it's a good analysis to start with and to develop over the last 40 years, is that part of it has to do with the false promises of the Democratic Party and the politics of the mainstream labor movement, who are intimately tied with one another. I mean, these are not strangers. The other is that it's also wrapped up in terms of what they appeal to, who they call the American worker, as opposed to this other working class that they see as their kind of fuzzy enemy, made up of immigrants and blacks and women, people who are openly gay and so forth, who they try to appeal to on the basis, particularly then, I mean, there's still some of it now, but anti-communism, especially when the Soviet bloc still existed and there was a rivalry for control of the world. They also appeal on the basis of nationalism. I think the far right's been very good at kind of tying together the crisis of the nation or the decline of the nation and the kind of weakening of very old ideas of gender and masculinity and how things should be to economic decline. And really what they end up voting for, and I think a lot have discovered this time and time again, are things that actually make their lives worse. The Teamsters have a peculiar history in this. I talked about this on Smith's program a few weeks ago, where I said, you know, the Teamsters were always known as the Republican Union, not that they didn't give money to Democrats, but there was a particular history, the role of the Kennedy brothers in attacking Hoffa, going after the Kennedy administration, had their own Get Hoffa unit. There was the role of Ted Kennedy and Jimmy Carter in the deregulation of particularly the trucking industry, but also the airline industry and other places. So there's that particular history. But it's also, I think we all knew why they were the Republican Union, which is that they were mobbed up for 40 years, and it was their way of keeping out of jail. Now, of course, the union, on one hand, is very different from what it was in those days. And on the other hand, it's also very similar to what it was in these days, even though the what we call the logistics industry, the trucking industry, the warehousing industry, are all very different from what they were 40 or 50 years ago, too. So,
can you go into that a little bit? Because you began by talking about this wholesale offensive against the working class that we're seeing under Trump. When we see the deployment of ICE, not trying to arrest criminals, but trying to arrest low-wage workers, and even Trump saying something like low-wage workers are part of these criminals and gangsters, and they're the ones that are being shackled and put in these detention centers and then deported. But also when you look at during the buildup for the practice strikes in the summer of 2023, mm-hmm. there were a lot of vocal Teamsters, and we saw that the Teamsters is a multi, you know, mm-hmm. a diverse yeah. union, and that the UPS truck drivers are not monolithic white men at all. And some of their demands, of course, were one in that strike and others weren't. I think you, in your book, you have a really poignant essay about UPS drivers who drive without air conditioning and how many mm-hmm. died, places like Phoenix and even other places across mm-hmm. the country, and that in the gains of that contract, they didn't get air conditioning, which was a very big demand. Mm-hmm. But just going into the composition of who the Teamsters are, how does it explain what you started to talk about in terms of the move to support the right and why it's still a kind of Republican union, even though its history of corruption is not at all the same as what it was? Or is it?
Well, I think there's a couple of things to keep in mind about the Teamsters, and they're big contradictions. I think that should be recognized. You know, the Teamsters, like many industrial unions, even though there's a lot of people in the Teamsters who don't work in industry, so to speak, they're in public sector or healthcare and so forth. It is a union that's very multiracial, very multi-ethnic. There are far more women in the Teamsters now than 40 or 50 years ago. And of course, you can't make any argument that the Trump administration is good for any of those people. And if it's not good for any of those people, they're not good for the rank and file of unions. I think the other way of saying it is also the fact that, however, is that the union itself is still overwhelmingly run by middle-aged white men. And I think that that's one of the contradictions in the union, not that it's entirely white or just men. One of the people being promoted by Sean O'Brien is Lindsay Doherty, who's head of the Hollywood Teamsters, who apparently has a tattoo of Hoffa Sr. on one of her arms, which unfortunately gives you a kind of cult-like feel to the leadership of the union that's still there, this kind of devotion to the great leader. On the other hand, I think that this big contradiction between what his membership is and what his leadership is the type of thing that a rank-and-file political organization is the one that should try to overcome this contradiction. And I think, you know, one of the problems over the last, you know, 6-7 years is that Teamsters for a Democratic Union, which, you know, had this very heroic past. I mean, I'm not going to take anything away from that. You and I both knew people who yeah. risked their lives to build TDU, most notably Pete Camrata, Bilal Chaka. I mean, many, many other people that I can't go into right now. And the problem is that instead of being a bulwark against this kind of Trumpism in the union and the policies of the international, they've struck up an alliance with O'Brien. And so instead of being critics, they're allies. Instead of being dissenters and oppositionists, they are defenders of that. So I think that this is really the contradiction and the crying need for something else that the modern Teamsters, rank and file, has to figure out, as workers do in so many other unions. It's not just a Teamster problem.
You know, TDU, Teamsters for a Democratic Union, as you began, Joe Allen, it was a grassroots movement from below within the Teamsters to democratize it, to, mm-hmm. could we say, de-gangsterize it,
yes.
you know, and to represent real workers' interests and to have workers in charge of their own union.
Right.
And it's been a long time,
right.
but it's always been thought of as a kind of beacon and an example mm-hmm. for democratic movements within the unions. And now you, within TDU, you still have some of the same people mm-hmm. who were there from the beginning. And as you just said, they've kind of made a tacit alliance with the O'Brien leadership, stewardship, maybe because they thought it was more militant and less whatever. But I mean, where does it go from here now that it seems to have betrayed its ideals by allying with a leadership that is Trumpist?
Well, I mean, they're going to have a convention in November here in Chicago, and I hope that they have a real debate. And I don't say real to be snarky. I hope they have a real debate that's wide-ranging about what has this alliance with O'Brien, and in effect, Trump, whether people want to believe that or not, I think they're living in denial about it, about what this has meant for them in the wider labor movement and its wider impact on working-class people in this country. And we'll see what the membership of TDU decides today. I think it's not just one thing, Susie. I think TDU has been around for a long time. And I'm sure that the people who pioneered it, many of whom were members or activists around the International Socialists, had one idea of what TDU was going to be, which was probably fairly short term. And then it ended up being a long-term project when both the rank-and-file movements from the 70s disappeared and the industries radically changed. I mean, it's the whole basis of the Teamsters and really of TDU was in freight, and except for, you know, one company called ABF, the vast majority of freight carriers in this country are non-union. So you have that as a factor. How can you survive as a rank-and-file group when rank-and-file politics is fairly marginal to these things? So do you, in effect, become more like a NGO and then the political problems with that? So I don't think it's just one thing. I think it's been a long 40, 50 years, and there not have been many survivors. But I think it's really time for a real assessment. I mean, there's a lot of people I knew, very good people. I mean, I'm not saying that they were dupes or engaging in some kind of fraudulent activity. They really believe that Sean O'Brien would lead them to a better place. And you have to say that nobody in 2021 would have ever thought this is where we would be in 2026. And so when things have changed so dramatically, then you need to have a very dramatic discussion about how we got here and what needs to be done now. I've seen one of the longstanding leaders of TDU, a man named Ken Sauvoir, who's now out of Kansas City, who said, let's let TDU be TDU again. And I think that's a good slogan. But I think that's also, people might want to ask is, what was it about TDU that got us to this place in the first place? So I think it's a big discussion.
It's a huge discussion, Joe Allen. And we are talking about the book that just came out, right? It's yes. Now available.
Right.
Wherever you buy your books, it's called Teamsterland, Reports on America's Most Iconic Union. Well, you've also written about logistics and Package King. And of course, the big contract fight was with UPS, which is right. One of the largest Teamster employers. But there's also various attempts to unionize Amazon that mostly now has its own trucks and its right. Drivers are not Teamsters. And that seemed at the time to have been very, very promising and something that would really revitalize a lot of the labor movement. So this is another issue that I would imagine will be discussed. Maybe you could just sort of wrap up by talking about, in this new convention that's obviously going to elect a new leadership, what are the discussions? Is that part of the discussion? How do we grow? How do we get to Amazon? Who's going to best lead us? Or is it all focused on criticism of leadership? What is it?
There's a lot of huge issues out there. I mean, it really is all about the existential threat of the faced by the entire labor movement. I mean, it's not just Trump. It's been the wide-ranging changes in the economy. You know, Amazon didn't exist in 1994. And now it's part of all of our lives in every way that it's unimaginable, far greater than, you know, when people talk about monopolies of the past, they had no idea what Amazon could be, right? There's all of those things is assessing the work at Amazon. In many ways, Susie, I think that one thing that's going on here in Chicago, which I see is really hopeful about changing the whole image of the Chicago Teamsters, who never had a very good image, is the strike at Mouser, which is a packing company that rehabs a lot of packaging and very toxic waste related barrels. It's really hard work. It's mostly an immigrant workforce. Many are undocumented. Teamsters 705 is doing a great job at maintaining the picket line and also promoting new language and contracts about protecting their workers from ICE. And while ICE doesn't really care about contracts or law, it's the type of strike that maybe not as glamorous or captures the imagination of something like Amazon. But I think in terms of day-to-day organizing and what it means for what the real working class is in this country, such as immigrant workers, Spanish-speaking workers, I think it really could change the image of the Teamsters and much of its organizing if we can win this one.
Well, we're going to have to end it there, but I really want to thank you. And you've ended on exactly the right note, because this is the key issue, right? Because the working class in the United States is largely immigrant, not completely, not by any means. Right. And now it faces, as we've seen, even in the case of the Hyundai workers who were raided and then sent back, that this is going to have a huge impact on the economy. And it really puts it front and center for the union movement, that this is what they have to organize on, and I really hope that they do. And as these struggles continue, Joe Allen, we're going to have you back. But I want to first just tell the listeners that you can buy his book. It's not a long book, so it's an easy read, and it's fascinating. It's a compilation of all the essays that he's written over the last period that touches on most of the issues that face the Teamsters and also kind of show what happens to the Teamsters is kind of a mirror for what happens to labor in the United States. The book is Teamsterland. Go out and get it. And Joe Allen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Susie.
And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guests, Sebastian Budgen and Joe Allen. Thanks, as always, to our producer and director, Melissa Figueroa, to executive producer, Robert Brenner, and to our engineer and editor, Juliana Gotha, and to Ossie Flamenco in Master Control. You can hear this and other archive shows in the Beneath the Surface archive at kpfk.org, or you can listen to the Jacobin Radio podcast wherever you get your podcasts. For more information on upcoming shows and guests, visit our Facebook page, Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Stay tuned now for Ian Masters and Background Briefing. I'm Susie Wiseman.
You always knew when Victor Young was in the studio or around, because he made his own cologne.